Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 122 with the title From Silence to Advocacy. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Emma Riley. Emma is the Programme Governance and Operation Manager for the Global Privacy Office of RX. And when I asked Emma to describe her superpower, she says she is articulate enough to speak in high-stress situations. Well, let's hope today isn't that stressful. Hello, Emma. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joanne. Thank you. Thank you for speaking with me.
Absolute pleasure. We met recently, I think, at an event in London, and you told me some of your story, which we'll get onto in a minute. I'm really fascinated to find out more. So I called this episode From Silence to Advocacy. Do you want to give me a bit of history of where you've been over the last few years, I guess?
A few years, more like a few decades. Short version, yeah. So I'm gay, but I didn't really know that until sort of mid to, I don't know, end of my teens, really, beginning of my 20s. But I had a history of being bullied a lot at school, so quite silent in that sense, in that I didn't get a lot of chance to sort of speak at that point. I then joined the military, the Royal Navy. And again, silence was very much part of my identity there, because at the time that I joined, it was illegal to be gay in the military. So we can talk about what happened to me then, but basically what's happened since then is that I've tried to use my voice where I can to do a little bit of good, to try and change what happened to me into something that actually does something better for the world than actually what happened to me. I hate bullying in all forms, and so I try and challenge that when I can now.
I'm also ex-forces. So I joined the RAF from school in 1981. Mm. At the time when Diana got married, it was that July.
Yes.
I joined in the October. So, and I remember it was drummed into you right from the very beginning around drugs are bad, being gay is bad. There's a lot of things are bad.
Yeah.
Or, but we want you to go and kill people, by the way, as well.
So, yes.
Yeah. These are the bad things you could do, but actually, this is something you should be thinking about. And I always remember that the sort of, there's always this kind of humor about if you were going to sit on someone else's bed, you had to make sure you had both feet on the floor, then it was okay. If you had to leave one foot on the, otherwise it was considered.
That's right. It was one foot on the ground. You had to keep one foot on the ground, which is fine, I suppose, if you're in the bottom bunk. But in a ship, you've got three bunks, one on top of the other. So if you're on the top bunk, you've got no hope.
But it was definitely drilled into you in those days that there was zero tolerance. And
oh, absolutely. When I joined, literally the first thing you do when you walk through the gates of Raleigh is you go in, you get sat down in this big sort of group room, and you get handed your contract to sign. And in the contract, it says that homosexuality is illegal. So when I'm there, 18 years old, and I only turned 18 about 3 weeks previous to joining. And I thought maybe I might be gay, but I wasn't sure. I'd never had any experience to actually confirm that. And having spent all my school years being bullied quite a lot, what I wanted was that sort of belonging that you can get as part of the military. I wanted to belong to that tribe. I wanted to serve my country. And so any thought of being gay was then straight off the table. That was not going to be happening to me. So it is right in front of you the moment you walk through the door that is not something you can be.
But how did you cope? Yeah, I mean, you've got some more depth to the story, which you're going to tell me in a minute. But so how did you manage to suppress, repress? Because you mentioned just now that you realized that sense of self later in life. So around the age of 18 is probably just where you start to figure stuff out.
So, well, as I said, I just wanted to serve my country. I wanted to belong. I wanted to be in that camaraderie that you can get in the military, because I'd just not experienced that as part of my school life at all. So I just threw myself into the training and I threw myself into the work, and I did really well at it. I was part of the last class of women to be trained separately from the men in the RENs. And so I had the choice whether to volunteer for C or not. And yes, that was an absolute yes for me straight away. So I then did my secondary training as a radio operator, HMS Mercury, and I was picked to be class leader of that class. And that was the first ever mixed sex class that went through HMS Mercury. So going through that as the class leader was a huge step up for an 18-year-old who was, you know, very unsure of herself at that point in time. But I mean, what an opportunity. And again, I did well in my schooling as far as that was concerned, and then came back, did my C training, and went off to join HMS Cornwall, a Type 22 Batch 3 frigate, as the first group of women to go on board that ship, which was a hugely lucky draft, actually. The other people in my class from Mercury went to, I think it was Ark Royal and Invincible, so our aircraft carriers, and they didn't go a huge distance, but with the Cornwall we did our basic operational sea training, and then we were lucky enough to do things like West Indies guard ships, so I got to see the Caribbean and America and so forth. So I was extremely lucky with my draft.
What year was it when women were finally allowed to leave the show and get on a ship there? What year was that?
It was basically 1990, which was when I joined. So I
1990.
It's 1990-91, they were starting to put women on board ships. So Cornwall were going through a refit as I came to the end of my secondary training. And so at the beginning of 91, I think it was, that I joined. And yeah, we were the first ones to join. It was quite a thing. There was a lot of resistance to having women on board. So there was that kind of overcome.
Yeah. I remember the stuff in the press, the First Sea Lord will say this will never work and all this kind of stuff. It was kind of, there was this, and then the ships weren't geared up for different people, were they? They were kind of, you're afloat, really. you just pile on top of each other. Suddenly, women, they didn't know how to communicate adequately with women. The language was.
Yeah. Well, you end up either being bullied, so you get called split turtle, bike, whatever, or you kind of become one of the lads. It's sort of a little bit of both of those two things, so you end up having to try and hold your own space if you can. And as somebody who'd been bullied and was not particularly confident in their own selves, that was quite a difficult situation to go through. But I absolutely loved being on board ship. It was brilliant, and again, I was good at what I was doing, so I really enjoyed it a lot.
Did you find that over time you were able to get respect?
I'd like to say yes. I unfortunately didn't quite find the sort of camaraderie that I was hoping for when I joined. I loved what I was doing, but I did end up in pretty much every place. I would get some kind of bullying. Like, for example, on board the ship, they, in West Indies guard ship, they put together like a local radio station. So, you know, somebody playing records or whatever and doing a bit of DJing in between. And they did a pretend, what's it called, request for me. And they said, and here's one for Emma Riley. And it was Tammy Wynette's Stand By Your Man. And of course, the first line is, sometimes it's hard to be a woman. And you just think, oh, for goodness sake. And then later on, when I was at, I think it was HMS Cochrane. So I was doing guard at a communications center and just outside HMS Cochrane. And in the women's block, there's a kind of in outboard. So everybody's, you know, you've got a little peg and you put it in, out, whatever, and you have your name next to it. And every day I would come back to find the W from my WRO, as we were called then. So REN radio operator, the W would be wiped out every day. Just little microaggressions that you called them now. I didn't know what it was at that point. It just made me feel outsider, basically. So there were some good people, But there was also that kind of stuff going on as well.
Now, all radio operators are just radio operators. There's no distinction now, is there?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in fact, the W officially got dropped not long after I left, I think. I'm not quite sure of the date.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I remember the similar sort of thing when I was in the Air Force around the WAFs and it was almost like, we have to allow women in, but they don't do anything serious. You know, they were great in the war, code-breaking, doing all the things that women were celebrated for. But actually firing a gun, not sure about that.
Oh, no.
Rifle, yeah.
Well, this is why they were calling us turtles, because if you're a turtle, because if you're on your back, you're fucked, excuse me. That's the sort of level that they were at that point in time. I'm sure it's a lot better now, but I'm sure also that there are plenty that are just as like that nowadays.
Never heard that slang before. That's that's awful, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not nice.
So you obviously had your naval career and you were enjoying it. You were good at what you did. You were presumably getting promoted, seen as excellent in what you were doing.
I was doing quite well. But fast forward. So that was 1990 I joined. So fast forward to 1993. I was more sure of my sexuality. Basically, I sort of needed to confirm in my own head what I thought I might be. And so one evening I went out in London on my own with nobody else. Nobody knew what I was going to do. And I basically went to a gay bar and got picked up. I kissed a girl and I liked it. So it was like, okay, all right. So let's file that away. I'm still not intending to do anything about it. I'm still, you know, completely no relationships, nothing like that. I'm still absolutely focused on wanting to serve and stay in the Royal Navy. But later on in 93, my father got really, really ill. So then my father's having quadruple bypass operation. He's having blackouts. I'm trying to support my mom going down to see him going in and out of hospital as that's all happening. And I'd found it harder and harder to deal with the sort of small bullying, but also to just hide who I was in my own self. It becomes incredibly stressful, the amount of mental energy that it takes to kind of hive off part of your personality, part of the core of yourself, is huge. So by the time I got to the sort of, it must have been September 1993, I was in not a great mental state. So I was working in the communication centre in HMS Faslane up in Scotland, the submarine base. And one day, myself and the person I was sharing a room with in the blob, we just went out for a drink in Helensburgh. And we'd had a few drinks. I thought she was my friend. And so I said, I think I might be gay, somewhere in the conversation. And she was pretty supportive at that point. So I had this really kind of euphoric moment where I thought, okay, I've said it out loud. And it's going to be okay. I don't have to do anything about it. I've said I'm not going to do anything. I still want to serve. I understand the rules kind of thing. And so I kind of came out of that evening a little bit on a high, if that makes sense. And then it was, next morning, get up, get dressed, get downstairs, you're under arrest. And what she'd done, of course, is phone up the military police and dobbed me in for being gay to them. So I had the SRB at my door the next morning.
They're pretty scary, aren't they?
Yeah, especially when you're asleep and they wake you up like that. Yeah, I was terrified. I mean, because you know the rules. So you know if they're going to be able to prove that you are gay, or that even that they prove enough to themselves that they think you are gay, that's it. It's all over. And this is all I've ever wanted to do since the age of about 13, 14. That's what I decided I was going to do with my life. So, I got up, I got downstairs and I got dressed. And then I was interviewed for, I don't know how many hours, 3-4 hours or something. You know, the old tape recorder interview, 2 SIB officers and a chief wren who was supposedly my support during this interview. And I mean, I can't remember the questions they asked, but it was just continuous pressure to admit that you were gay. And at one point, I just got so upset that they stopped the tape and said, okay, let's have a 15-minute break and you can calm down. And I must have said something to that chief wren in the break that was incriminating in some way, because I remember the moment the SIB came back in the room and they turned on the tape and the chief wren was like, right, during the break, Emma Raleigh said this, that, and the other. And you just think, that's it. She's not my support. I am completely alone in this. It's just a joke that they have somebody there to supposedly support you. Then nobody's interested in that. They just want to get that conviction. So after that, they take you up to your room to go and search through all your belongings. And
looking for what? What are they looking for?
Well, this is the thing, right?
Of being gay.
Well, you say that in a joking way, but literally, we're standing outside the door, these two SRB officers and this narky chief wren. And one of the officers says, so do you have any electrical equipment? And I'm thinking, what? So I, to my credit, I said something along the lines of, well, if you mean dildos or vibrators, no, but please do search the rest of the block. I'm sure you'll find some. I think, for how on earth is that in any way proof of lesbianism that you might have some electrical equipment, especially in a women's block? I mean, really. But yeah, they went through everything. And actually, evidence-wise, about the only things they got were, I had a few letters to a pen pal who was outside the Royal Navy where I had spoken about the fact that I thought I might be gay. So, okay, there's a piece of real evidence, right? The other two pieces of evidence that I remember are the Suede album cover. And I don't know if you remember the first Suede album cover, but it was basically two people kissing, a sort of a CPF photo of two people kissing. And there was this big debate on at the time about, is it a man and a woman, two women, two men? Who is this? And so they took that as evidence. Now, as it happens, it is actually two women, one of whom is in a wheelchair. But nobody really knew that at that point in time. So a Suede album cover was evidence. The best one was that they confiscated my Julian Clary mincing tour video. Because, again, anybody who watches Julian Clary obviously must be gay, right? I laugh about this now. At the time, it was so humiliating and so terrifying. And actually, what they were looking for is not only proof that I was gay, but they were looking for names.
Yeah, they wanted other people, didn't they?
They wanted other people. Witch hunt, it was such a witch hunt era. And having spoken to other veterans now in the last couple of years who've gone through similar experiences, I mean, I can tell you stories. Like, there was one poor gentleman I spoke to who, he'd been thrown out because of his sexuality, and they'd found another military person's name in his belongings, gone after this chap, and this poor chap that they'd gone after committed suicide. So this man has been thrown out. He's lost his livelihood, his life, his identity, etc., etc., and now has to not only deal with the shame of that, but also carry the guilt of that other man's death on his conscience for the rest of his life. It's the mental cruelty is astounding.
So you find out what the motivation was for your friend to, was there a motivation? Was there a kind of a...
I never spoke to her again. They moved me out of the room with her, of course, but still in the same block. And of course, I'm still in the same base. I'm still eating in the same mess, though I'm not working in the same place as I'd say. Everybody knows what's going on. And pretty much everybody keeps their distance from you. There were a couple of people who were really kind to me that I remember. But most people don't want to be tarred with the same brush. They want to, you know, keep that distance. But no, I never spoke to that person to find out why they did what they did. In fact, as I've done a few bits of speaking, particularly in schools, actually, they ask, so what would you do if you ever met that person again? How do you feel about them? And I kind of vacillate between, on the one hand, you know, being generous. They were following the rules. They did what they were supposed to do, which is tell the military police that there was a gay in their midst, terrifying as that may be. And on the other hand, you just wonder, what threat was I, seriously? Supposedly a national security threat, because if I'm gay, then I can be blackmailed. Well, the only reason you can be blackmailed is because you've got a rule in place that you're not supposed to be gay. And all this nonsense about gay people being able to, in positions of power, what's the word? Make a junior do their will, you know,
coerce.
Bring them into the gay world. Yeah. Coerce them. Yeah. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for.
Coerce them into their gay
world, right? It's an utter nonsense, because when you're looking at the differences between males and females, You know, there's just as much chance a male officer or a female officer will do the same to a junior of whatever sex as there is if they're gay. It the whole thing is an absolute nonsense.
Yeah, I've also experienced the SIB for different reasons at the time. And as a result of someone reporting me for something, and I won't go into that on this podcast. I've probably done it on a previous one. But yeah, I also was interviewed with two scary men, basically pointing, shouting, thumping their fist on the table, telling me, confess now, it would be much easier. We're going to have you in the end. If you don't get it over and done with, you know, if you just come out with it now, this will all be over and we can move on. It was like, there's an immense amount of pressure and bullying to make you conform.
Absolutely.
And I was I was 18 at the time. I was kind of scared. Yeah, I'd done something wrong. Yeah, I had. Like you, I knew it was wrong. It's part of those 10 rules you shan't do when you're in the forces. And and again, the blackmail and all these sort of things and people feeling like that. And it's a scary time, isn't it? And I ended up exiting the forces via a little town in Essex called Colchester. So I spent a few days, which is the that's the military prison or the place you exit the military if you've been convicted. So I got charged and taken in front of the station commander, hat off, march in, get told your punishment, walk out. I didn't elect for court martial. I was I thought it's not going to get any better than this, so just get rid of me. It's a tough time when you're that young, when you're I'm not trying to sit here and say I was innocent. I on the scale of things, what I did was not huge. I mean, what you did was you kissed one girl and said,
"Well, you know, and that's it." I was extent. Literally nothing else. Yeah, I think that's the thing that seems to mark particularly the cases against gays in the military is the mental cruelty and so forth that goes with it. I mean, for me, there was all of that that had happened, but then they sent me home to tell my parents. That was pretty horrific. A forced coming out. So they sent me home, and you know, I have to tell my parents that not only am I going to likely exit the Royal Navy, and they are so proud of me serving, you know, but also that I'm gay, and I'm absolutely terrified. Absolutely terrified. I remember viscerally the room where I was sitting when I was trying to tell my parents all about this, and I spoke to my mum, you know, in the last couple of years, and say how was I, because there's only so much you can hold on to from these days. And she said it took me about 5 or 6 hours to stop crying long enough to actually tell them what was going on, which horrific. So I go back up to the base and survive the last couple of weeks, however long it was. And then you go up to captain's table and it's your judgment is given and it's discharged. Sure, your services are no longer required. And they...
I've got one of those.
Made redundant,
basically.
Basically, yes. So, I mean, in many ways, my exit was a lucky one because it was an honourable discharge, quote unquote. I didn't get the red writing at the top for dishonorable discharge. So that didn't affect my future employment or anything like that, as far as that part of it is concerned. I mean, they made me sign a piece of paper to say that I wasn't going to challenge the decision. And so I did sign it, but I said the only reason I'm not challenging the decision now is because my father is so ill. Because again, you've got to remember, my father's just had a quadruple bypass. So he's not in the best of health as all of this stuff is going on. And then that was it, 26th of November, 1993. Hand your kit back, which I basically unceremoniously dumped it all on the quartermaster's floor as I left. And I kept everything that wasn't on my kit list. So I have a really random assortment of bits and pieces. Like I think I've got a tie, a shirt, a cap, and a greatcoat. The greatcoat I only wore for the first time last year to march with Fighting With Pride to the Cenotaph as part of the Remembrance Day Parade. That's how long it's taken me to even put that on. So it was pretty horrific. And then I go home. My parents collected me. My parents hated what was going on to me, and they absolutely hated how they were treated at the gates because they were totally given the silent treatment, like persona non grata. They didn't want anything to do with my parents, and there was just me coming out of this gate on my own. It was pretty horrific. And then, yeah, I have to go home and redraw my entire map of the world, basically. Find out, who am I? Now I'm not in the military. Am I really gay? Am I not? Find some kind of identity, because, of course, in the military, your identity is all wrapped up in what you do. That is who you are. You are the job. And actually work out what in the heck I was going to do for work, because I had no clue. So I spent maybe 5-6 weeks at home licking my wounds and trying to start living again, I guess. Just, I don't know. And then you kind of have to put one foot in front of the other. So I ended up looking at my skills from the military and going, okay, so what can I do? Well, I can shoot an SA-80, but that's not that useful in civilian life. But as a radio operator, they teach you how to type. So, and I typed at like 65 words per minute or something like that with very few mistakes. So I thought, okay, well, I'll just go to a temp agency and say I can type. And I ended up doing some like filing clerk and, you know, all that kind of low level stuff, bit of temp work here, there, everywhere, and did that for a while. And then ended up doing a filing job for one company that turned into a permanent job for a bit. And that was quite useful, because it gives me my first taste of the corporate world. And I found out that I was quite good with like fax machines, if you remember those, and printers, you know, stuff like that. So it was a bit like technical, because we'd done stuff like that in the military, and you just learn to give it a go and try and work out what was going on. So when I decided I wasn't going to do that anymore, I thought I'd find another position. And I ended up finding a position as a help desk call taker. So I wasn't fixing anything, but I was taking the calls to log them. But as part of that, I started learning and starting fixing things, and ended up from there joining what was then Butterworth Tolly, part of LexisNexis Group now, as an IT analyst, like a base level IT desktop support person, and ended up, you know, opportunity, as I either got bored or as opportunities came, I would go, oh, look, there's an opportunity of that. Okay, let's give that a go. And then, you know, I ended up running the desktop support for LexisNexis in the UK, which was, you know, it was a great job, quite stressful at times, you know, as desktop support normally is. And then various things happened, and I ended up working in project engagement for the IT thing. And then that sort of changed into project governance for a while. And then I ended up doing project governance at another group company. And I've now ended up, through being a program manager for the Privacy Office, I'm now doing program governance and operations. So I'm managing a team in Manila who do stuff for our Privacy Office for our company. I run projects. So we're literally in the middle of kicking off 7 Asia Pacific projects at the moment for privacy programs. And I absolutely could not have told you in a million years that is what I would have ended up doing. I'm basically a jack of all trades and master of none. And at 50, almost 52, I've started to work out actually what I'm quite good at. But I also think, just imagine if I'd exited the military on my own terms, I probably would have been in this position 5, 10, maybe even 15 years ago. So the effect on my career has been quite devastating. And that doesn't even touch what the effect has been on my mental health, or how I've interacted with people, or my relationships, or trust, and so on and so forth. So there's a huge other piece to it that gets impacted.
Do you think what you went through at that young formative age helped you build some resilience? I mean, I look back at my life and I think, actually, when you have all that worry, all that stress, all of that stuff going on in your head, the fact that you're now thrown out into the street, no career, all the shame, all the pressure around you, you can sit there and cry and huddle up in a ball, or you can say, okay, dust yourself down, as you said. I think it's going to do. Yeah. I was filing, and I did this, and I got a job through what I was doing as a temp and doing all this. And suddenly I built a new career, and I look back at some of the people who stayed in the apprenticeship course that I was on, and they said, to be honest, after we left training, it was never as good as we thought it was going to be. It was a bit of fun. We had a laugh, but actually the best years were the 3 years at the beginning, which I did. So I look back and think, okay, I got into Civvy Street and built a life, rather than maybe exiting in my late 30s, early 40s, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
And having to start again, having been, if you like, indoctrinated into the military lifestyle and way of thinking. So Yeah, I look back and think, yeah, I'm not going to put it on my CV as a learning opportunity. But you know, with hindsight, it did actually give me something. It matured me up really. And I look back now and think, you could never get this worse, it's bad again. Yeah, if I can handle that, I can handle anything.
Yeah, and it's one of my favourite phrases is worst things happen at sea, which I can completely attest to. You know, if you've had a fire at sea or any of the other things that have happened to me, you can, yeah, it's nothing worse than that. And I do agree, having gone through that, it definitely built resilience. In fact, I was talking for my company on they did a Pride, not podcast, well, I suppose you call it a podcast, basically just a broadcast, you know, for the company, then where they interviewed me for what I'd done and what I'd gone through. And unbeknownst to me, our CEO was listening. And at the end, they bring him on to say a few words. And what was interesting to me and quite amazing to me is that he said, people like me make great executives because they've gone through so much, they've overcome so much, they don't get phased by the small stuff. So your ability to hold and manage stress and stressful situations or complex situations is a lot higher than somebody who's not gone through that kind of experience. Now, like you, I would certainly never advocate going through that kind of experience as a learning tool, because frankly, I really wish I hadn't. And it's damaged me in many different ways. But from that perspective, yes, there is an advantage, if you like, in that I've been able to do that. I would add, though, that there has to be a kernel of resilience in you to begin with to be able to build on. Because, again, hearing some of the stories from veterans, you can see who's had that and who hasn't had that. It a lot of the time, I think it depends on what support you have when you come out. I was lucky that my parents were completely supportive of me, so I had a home to go to. And I know many had not only just had their careers destroyed and their identity ripped away, but they also then had their family's doors slammed in their faces. So there's many layers to that.
You didn't take this line down, though, did you? I want to hear what happens next.
So what happened next?
In the middle of getting thrown out and starting your new life, you did something quite extraordinary. And I'd love to hear more about what you did to change the UK.
Well,
you changed the world.
So I had, as I said, written on the paper, you know, I'm only not challenging this because my father is so ill. Well, that was always in the back of my mind. So I got thrown out. I sort of started my career build, and I got to about 5 years into it, and I had a permanent job that I was enjoying. So this is when I was working as help desk at that point. I had a girlfriend for the first time, the second time, in fact. So it's a much more a serious relationship. And I felt comfortable enough in my own self and sexuality and my career and who I was at that point, where I thought, okay, this is the moment where I can start to look at doing something about it. Because it comes back to that thing. I hate bullying because I'd been bullied all the way through school. I'd been bullied in small ways even when in the military. And then at the end of it, bullied institutionally by being harassed and humiliated and thrown out of it. So I wanted to try and change the narrative. So I basically phoned up Stonewall. And I have to thank whoever I spoke to on that particular call, because they gave me the number of a solicitor who was taking another case, a similar one to mine, about being thrown out of the military. And I phoned up that person, who was Stephen Gross of Bindman and Partners, and spoke to him, and he took my case, basically. So I self-funded myself. So this is all alone. And I know at the time there were rank outsiders doing lots of things sort of politically, pressure-wise, and also building cases for what would become the four headline cases at the time. But I just went alone to this solicitor, told my story and said, I want to do something about it. And what we did first was you have to go into the UK courts first. So I took the Ministry of Defence to court. So it was me versus the Ministry of Defence. And it didn't work. It was trying to say that sexuality should be in the same category as gender as far as discrimination is concerned. And basically, the UK courts didn't allow that. There was a precedent from Southwest Trains that was used to throw the case out. And the case itself was, it was the only time I actually went into a court, because it went, it was a public hearing. So I was there with my barrister, and then there was, I think, three QCs who would, they'd be King's Counsel now, but then Queen's Counsel then, for the Ministry of Defence. So it's like, it was ridiculous. It was David and Goliath. And that was quite a scary experience, to sit in that courtroom as that whole thing was being talked through. But as I said, we found out that that wasn't going to go ahead because of this previous precedent. So then the only other option that we have is to effectively take the UK to court in the European Court of Human Rights. So we have more conversations, more evidence gathered that I can talk about, and the whole thing gets filed out with the European Court of Human Rights. So that is now the beginning, sort of April-ish, I think, in 1998. And so every so often we get letters back and forth. There's another question that they ask. We are trying to get transcripts of my interview tapes, which, oh, surprisingly, the Royal Navy have lost. Oh, isn't that interesting? Yeah. The military, the Royal Navy and the Ministry of Defence were doing anything and everything in their power to squirm out of having to change the law. And so every challenge we made would be met with some other kind of ridiculous question or evasion or no or whatever. So we just kept on back and forth answering these questions until it came to the end of 1999. I think it was September the 27th, 1999, and the European Court of Human Rights ruled on those four headline cases with the pressure of the other cases like mine behind it, and said, it is a violation of Article 8, I think it was, in which everybody has a right to a private life. And effectively, they stated that the ban on homosexuals serving in the military was illegal. So at the end of 1999, the government were handed this ruling, and that meant that on January 12th, 2000, the law was changed to allow gay people to serve in the military. I would say, Labour likes to say, trumpet, if you like, that they were the ones that lifted the ban. And I can absolutely attest to the fact that they and the Conservatives, and frankly, any other political party that was around at the time, none of them wanted to lift it. And the only reason that ban was lifted was because I and the other people put our heads above the parapet and took them to the European Court of Human Rights.
As you say in the notes here, it took another 23 years from that date to get any semblance of an apology, compensation.
Yep. Yes, although that's on that as well, they're kicking that one into the long grass as much as they can. Yeah, 23 years. And the only reason they even started to do any of this stuff is because people got together again, LGBT veterans got together again and started pressurizing them to actually look into the damage that they'd created. Because what they did was change the law and go, hooray, everybody can serve now. And then again, promptly forgot us, having forgotten us the moment they closed the door on our backs. And basically, I mean, from my own personal experience, I spent, you know, decades not talking about it. I didn't talk about it to anybody. And I didn't interact with other human beings in the same way that you would normally do. Like, I mean, I give an example of which is I joined a choir in 2002. So it's a women's choir. And at the moment, at that time, I'm now an openly gay woman. That's all fine. But what I was so terrified of was ever being called a predatory lesbian, or I was so worried about me looking at somebody the wrong way, quote unquote, that they would think that I was fancying them. Or if I would be terrified that if somebody was upset and I maybe put my hand on their shoulder to try and say it's okay, I'd be worried. I wouldn't do that because I'd be terrified that they'd think that I was trying to come onto them or something. You know, you as a choir, you have to change in a changing room before you go on stage and you put your makeup on, blah, blah, blah. And I would always try and find like the corner and like look as much as possible at the wall or the corner or away from everybody because I was so worried that somebody would take it the wrong way. So it's just really debilitating in that kind of sense. And then you don't feel worthy of the work you're doing. You don't feel worthy of being in the relationship. So you don't necessarily treat yourself to the relationships that you really deserve. And it's only since my early 40s, so my 10 years ago, that I've started to really work through those trust issues. I had counseling really for the first time a couple of years back because my wife has two children and I went in at teenager, which is quite a difficult time for them as well as being difficult just generally for anybody. And so there were times in that journey of being with them and learning how to be a step parent and all of those things that, you know, teenagers challenge things. And for various circumstances, there was some very challenging behavior going on a few years back that was in direct kind of opposition to my core values of truth and not lying and not bullying. And so all of that got wrapped up in a very difficult situation. And I found I had to talk to somebody about it. And I'd never done that before. And that really showed me how much of my life had been protecting that inner self. And honestly, the only reason that I can really speak with you now is because I met the person who's now my wife, and I was able to start relaxing into being vulnerable with somebody for probably the first time in my life. I completely credit her with bringing me alive, basically, in front of everything. And being allowed to start speaking of it was a long journey. I only started speaking of it really properly as an actual story, maybe 2016 or something like that. I got contacted by a professor who is writing a book called Going to Strasbourg, who is looking at cases taken to the European Court of Human Rights by women and men about gender or sexuality. And he'd found my name as part of somebody else's materials and desperately wanted me to be part of the book because there were so few women who took the cases forward. It was mostly men.
I just listened to what you're saying there about, obviously, you internalized all of the hate, all of the you're not good enough, all of that kind of thing, as you're thinking to yourself, I'm the predator. All this must be hugely difficult. And I was going to say, and it's not trying to cast aspersions, men walk into a room and they check women out, but you walk into a room as a woman and you're worried about checking women out. And that's kind of, you're feeling that kind of the whole sense of oppression about your identity and everything. And
completely. It's kind of the reason, as I said, I sort of started talking. That first conversation I had with Paul Johnson for the book was deeply distressing to talk it through because I'd never told it as a story from start to finish with all of the detail that I've now gone into with you. And yet that was really powerful for me because that experience of talking to him, the way that he explained how important that had been, meant that allowed me to start talking about it and thinking about it a bit more. The next thing that happened is that my stepdaughter asked me to give a presentation to her school. So I got asked by the school, a secondary school, to go in and do an assembly, and it was the whole school. And so for the first time in my life, I put a PowerPoint presentation together. I got some photographs together. I thought, right, okay, I've got 20 minutes or 25 minutes to tell my story and get something positive out of the end of it. Because you can't just tell your story and go, well, there's it. In my opinion, I wanted to be able to try and bring the point that one person can actually change things. And yes, I was one person going to the European Court of Human Rights. I wasn't the only one, but I know that without my case and the other people who independently did it, we just simply wouldn't have got that change. So you do have to have that inner knowledge that one person can change the world. So I did this talk, which was terrifying. I've never done speaking before in my life, and I'm standing at the front of an assembly hall with 11 to 15-year-olds blankly looking back in their hormonal fog. And you never know how this thing is going to land. But I found out a few years later, we met a mum of one of the kids who'd seen that assembly. And she said, do you know, that assembly, my kid came back and said, this was the most amazing talk he'd ever seen. You see, you just don't know who you're affecting. With my singing, I've done leadership stuff. So we have a general convention once a year. And as part of that, I was on stage doing some MC work, organizing some of the weekend. And at that time, I basically said to myself, long before, I'm not going to be in the closet. So I was an out gay woman on stage in a position of responsibility. And about 10 years later, we met a woman who's an opera singer. And her first ever route, if you like, into singing was to sing barbershop, which is the style that we sing. And so she'd come on to one of the competitions and about 13 or 14 years old, questioning her sexuality. So she wasn't sure if that was who she was. She thought she was, but she was scared of that whole thing inside her. So she came along to this convention and saw me up on stage, openly gay woman in a position of responsibility, respected and talked to in a normal way. And that was the moment that crystallized for her, actually, it's going to be okay. I can be gay and it will be okay because I can be respected. And I literally would never have known that if we hadn't met her 10 years later through my wife's work. But it is really key to be able to be your authentic, open self in any sphere that you possibly can, because you never know who you're going to affect just by being yourself.
You feel there's pressure on you to be out and open, an openly gay woman. You said that, use that phrase a couple of times. You feel there's pressure to be the visible role model or to show that inspiration.
I definitely don't call it pressure, but I do say that visibility is critical. You can't be what you can't see. And actually, one of the things that my company is really good at is having people visible of different kinds. My CFO is a gay woman. I'm out there as well, you know, being openly gay. And there are various other people who are doing the same kind of work. And even in my, you know, singing organization, I gave you that example, and I'm on the Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Council for it to help ensure that we move in the right direction as far as gender equality is concerned. And it just is so important to be able to see a version of yourself up there to say, actually, it is safe to be who you are. You can be anything. You can be on stage and sing and be gay. You know, you can be CFO and be gay. You can do talking on the television or the radio and actually be listened to and understood and be allowed that platform to be able to try and reach people so that people can be connected and understand that they are good, excellent human beings. I always say, so I volunteer for Diversity Role Models, which is a charity that goes into schools and does workshops to try and end LGBT bullying. Building empathy with kids who generally don't speak to real gay people until they leave school. So I go in there and tell my story and kind of shake them up a bit because it's a bit dramatic. But the long and the short of it is I say, you know, we're all skin bags of blood and bones. There's no real difference between us. You know, how you choose to present your particular skin bag is completely fine. And whether that person is religious or not, whether that person is gay or not, transgender or not, one sex, intersex, etc., etc., it literally doesn't make any difference. You are all the same material underneath.
Pride's coming up in June. I mean, this episode probably go out after June, but we talk about Pride being a protest as well as a celebration. We're living in a world in 2024 here where there's this pushback on wokeness. We hear it all the time. It's being weaponized. Do you feel that people are kind of saying to you, come on, Emma, can you just put your gayness away for a bit? And, you know, more important to talk about.
Yeah. My work colleagues say, oh, you've gotten another award or something. Is that for the gay stuff then? It like becomes a thing. Well, yes and no. Pride is a protest as well as a celebration. And the fact that there are still people out there who are terrified of telling their parents or their colleagues or, you know, whatever, that they're gay, transgender, etc., etc., is it still needs to be highlighted and these safe spaces still need to be created. It's why companies in particular, I think, need to make sure that they are on top of things like diversity, equity, inclusion, because somebody needs to be allowed to be their full authentic self at work in order to release that mental brain space, even from a simple productivity point of view, to be able to put their whole self into their work. And I have also said, you know, if you're at work, that may be your only safe space for various reasons. Maybe at your home space, the there is a religious reason or a cultural reason why being gay or transgender is not something that you can speak about. But at your workplace, you should be able to be fully engaged and fully there. There are so many layers to this. So many layers. But yeah, it does need to be visible. It needs to be a protest, because you can see how many of the laws and gains that we've made are under attack at all times. And it needs to be a celebration, because there's nothing more powerful than people walking in pride together.
Oh, you feel that immense sense of, I don't know, your chest puffs out. You feel proud in pride, don't you?
Yeah.
You know that it's the only space, well, it's one of the only spaces you can walk and know you'll be accepted by everybody around you, because we're all there for one purpose.
It's, yes, exactly.
Immensely powerful. Immensely powerful. And my wife often tells the story that we went to Pride on the Isle of Wight when it was World Pride, which was probably 5-6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time that she felt comfortable being with me and talk about things in that kind of way that made her believe that it was normal. We were just a normal couple with a different flavor, maybe. And it was the first time she felt that. And I think you're right. Pride is there as a safe space to allow people to believe as well. And I think that's incredibly powerful.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've got a vision. Yeah, what next? You know, your mission isn't complete on the service ban. You know, we want compensation. We want all these other things, but it's...
Yeah. And as much as anything else, the more I can speak publicly about this, the more I can try and reach other veterans who maybe haven't heard about the reparations, who haven't had that opportunity to connect with other veterans, because to be able to tell your story to somebody who really understands is a very powerful thing. That happened to me a couple of weeks back. I met a person whose wife had been thrown out of the RAF in 1984, and she'd said it to a couple of friends and so, and they are legitimately horrified. But we met and she told her story to me, and that's the first time she's spoken of it with a veteran who knows exactly what she went through, knows the terror and the shame, understands the mental cruelty that you go through. I mean, she'd been kept hanging around for 6 months, given different dates. And the worst part of it was they used her as bait to get a corporal. How mentally destructive is that? And there are so many stories of that kind of thing. But connecting veterans with veterans who have that common military service, but also crucially that common experience of having gone through these discharges, is very crucial. And frankly, also getting people to apply for the compensation, particularly the financial compensation, because we need to pressure the government to actually come through with that money. People have been destroyed, lives destroyed, careers never happened because people didn't have the mental capacity to go through. So they've had housing difficulties, relationship difficulties, health difficulties. People have died for this. And the government
we've had people who've served in conflicts and wars who've lost their medals and recognition, and not just finance, but stripping them of everything they've ever achieved. And
the humiliation.
Humiliation. And it's devastated lives, as you say. And I think we need more than the apology. We need restitution and reformation about what's happened.
Absolutely. And they are making, finally, due to pressure, strides towards that.
I think there's, and I'm not going to knock what they're doing, but it's kind of a cop-out. When something happens 20 or 30 years earlier, it's easy to be sorry. It doesn't cost anything to be sorry today. You can say whatever you like, because it's not you. You're apologizing on the sins of the past or your predecessors. And it's easy to throw people under a bus 20 years later.
Absolutely. I was one of only two veterans looking directly down at Rishi Sunak when he apologized on behalf of the state to LGBT veterans. And it was a very pretty piece of speech, as was Keir Starmer's afterwards. But actually the one that hit home was the then Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, had a space in the political programme of that day a little bit later to talk about it. And he gave a proper, nuanced, personal, with humility, apology that referenced the fact that he was an officer at the time and he was part of the problem. And having met gay people like MP Crispin Blunt later, he finally understood the real impact of what he'd been party to at the time. And so his contrition had far more emotion behind it than ever did the two heads of parties.
Yeah. Emma, wow. Thank you. I really value your candor and openness and telling your story here today. So, yeah, absolutely powerful. How can people get hold of you?
You can find me on LinkedIn. I have a website, emmariley.uk. Please do contact me through either of those things. And yeah, I do have a full-time job, but I do work as much as I can to try and help around that, to get the message out there and try and help people understand this history a little bit more.
Thank you. As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.